Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And today we have a very special guest, longtime friend of the show, friend of me, friend of everybody, really. We have a great veteran, both of the military and of the movie industry, and a seeming favorite of Joe Johnston because he's been in quite a few Joe Johnston films. My friend from long ago in Brewster, New York, and one of the members of the Veterans Military Advisors Group, Mr. Rory Arrowood. Rory, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here. It's good to see some familiar faces, including yours, Jim.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We're a little grayer, a little more wrinkly, but Rory and I have spent many a night sitting in movie theaters talking over people while we're watching movies. Long before Mystery Science Theater, we would go over to Star Wars in too much graphic detail, to the chagrin of other audience members.
So you're that jerk.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm right there with you.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah. Anyway, that's why they've closed down so many theaters lately. Rory, before we get to talk with you about some different parts of this movie, of which you may be familiar, Hal, why don't you give us a synopsis of what's going on in minute 22?
All right, here we go. Steve Rogers packs up books in his barracks. Colonel Phillips stands tall on the dusty training grounds of Camp Lehigh, his voice booming over the recruits. Made up of the best minds in the free world, our goal is to create the best army in history, but every army starts with one man. Steve Rogers, scrawny and determined, stumbles during an obstacle course, tumbling backward into a net. The trainer's shout cuts through the air. Rogers, get off of there! Phillips continues, undeterred, his eyes scanning the recruits. At the end of this week, we will choose that man. He will be the first in a new breed of super soldier. Steve crawls under barbed wire, struggling as the sharp metal snags his uniform. Gilmore Hodge kicks the side of the barbed wire frame. The frame collapses on top of Rogers. The trainer barks again. Rogers, get that rifle out of the mud! Phillips' voice grows resolute. And they will personally escort Adolf Hitler to the gates of hell. The trainer's commands intensify, relentless. Pick up the pace, ladies. Let's go, let's go. Double time. Come on, faster, faster. Move, move. Squad, halt! He points to a flagpole in the distance. That flag means we're only at the halfway point. First man to bring it to me gets a ride back with Agent Carter. Move, move! Recruits scramble, clawing at the pole, desperation in their eyes. Come on, get up there. That's all you got?
Wow, it's like you're there. It's like...
and now my voice feels like Brian's. With all the fake quiet yelling.
Wow. Well, this is an interesting way of picking people out from. I don't know how much individual training follows a week of boot camp from what they're talking about here. But Rory, what was your experience with from induction into basic? How did you have a Gilmore Hodge in your squad?
Yeah. So I went through Army basic training and infantry training at Fort Benning, Georgia in 1987. And some of it is just so familiar, and other stuff had obviously changed quite a bit. A week into the program, yeah, we're not doing any of that stuff. We're still just being kind of like, not beaten up, but just harassed on a day-to-day basis. We hadn't gone to the obstacle course yet. We didn't have our rifles yet. They came later. The basic principles haven't changed, but certainly the methodology is different than it was in World War II.
Okay, so I know that some of this is called a confidence course, which by breaking you down, they're actually building you up, saying, "Gee, I can really do this part." I mean, is that, do you feel that's the way it's related in this basic training?
I think that's the underlying impression. I mean, what they're doing is the cargo nets and the barbed wire. The barbed wire is usually accompanied by people firing machine guns over your head as a way of encouraging you not to get up. And the other thing that I noticed in the scene is you know, that he kicks the post out. It's like, yeah, good luck, because you'd break your fibula before you kicked the post out. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of knuckle draggers hammered that into the ground with enthusiasm. So that thing is 4 feet deep, and if you can kick it out with your foot, you're the super soldier. Let's, yeah. You know, stop the hunt.
No serum required. Yes.
You're not that bright, but we got plans for you, son.
Yeah. Building on that. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say it building on what you're talking about. It seems to me that the basic training, at least in this scene, is meant to develop and assess two kinds of toughness, physical toughness and mental toughness. And we see here that Steve Rogers doesn't have physical toughness. He doesn't have endurance. He's not fast. But he's we're shown again, yet again, and continuously that he's got mental toughness. He's got that heart.
Grit is a huge thing. I mean, if you look at like the smallest American hero ever was a 4 foot. He was 4 foot nine. Captain Richard Flaherty is a decorated Vietnam War Green Beret, known as the Giant Killer. A little guy. But did that matter? No. Audie Murphy, you know, is barely allowed to be in the Army. And they keep, you know, trying to slide him off into being a clerk or something like that. But he was, you know, committed to the idea of being a rifleman in an infantry company. So, yeah, I mean, your stick-to-itiveness is a lot of it. And basic training is basic training. It's like every man's stuff. But, I mean, you look at Navy SEAL training, and they're just tormenting you for weeks just to see who's going to quit. You know, they, what do they call the sugar donuts, where you go in the water and then you come out and you roll in the sand. Anybody who's had sand in their clothes knows that this is an unfortunate circumstance to be ended immediately. And they just keep you like that, you know, which is why so many guys drop out like initially, like right away. Yeah, no, not doing this. So yeah, that's a huge part of it, especially if you're going to be Captain America.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know,
Rory, did you find, pardon me.
Oh, go ahead, Al. No.
Did you find in your basic training experience that was there camaraderie right away, or was there competition? You know, I know, you know, Jim was asked about a Gilmore Hodge kicking things out and you said he's just going to break bones, but were you guys supporting each other for the most part, or was there anybody that might be a saboteur?
So it's a very interesting dynamic, because like officer training is a very different thing. You know, officer training, you're assessing leadership and stuff. I mean, basic training is, do you follow instructions? Do you have the stamina and grit to get through the program? We'll figure out the rest later. And I found like there were some guys who had that kind of like enforcer mentality, like they wanted to be in charge and they wanted to push people around. Other people were smart. I was called college boy because I'd already been to school when I went to basic training. Not in a loving way, by the way. One thing that fascinated me about the dynamic is that in basic training, you know, there's a pack mentality, you know, a crab tank mentality. But these same guys, these same knuckle draggers, like when you get your commission, when you become an officer, they're proud of the fact that you're smart, but they're not really jazzed about having like, you know, an Einstein in the midst. And they will definitely push back on that. Well, I will tell you one telling story. I got my nose broken in basic training about 9 weeks into a 14-week program. And I'm going to the base hospital with my drill sergeant, and I'm 25. He's like 33. So he's kind of like, we're more, a little more relaxed to each other because nobody else is around. And there was a guy in my group named Angeli, and Angeli seemed to me to be a nutcase. Like there was something off about Angeli. And there was another guy who was like big, like he was like Hodge. He was a big, dumb guy. And I said to the drill sergeant, I said, why is Angeli still here? he said, it's like this. We don't know. He said, we throw all you guys in, we put you through the training, If you make it through the training, you go out into the force, because for all we know, the big tough guy is laying at the bottom of this foxhole crying for his mom the first time we get into a fight, and Angeli wins the Medal of Honor. He said, we just don't know. So unless you do something horrendously stupid or you seem like you're a danger, then we're going to put you through the system and see what comes out the other end.
Wow. Now, so, you've been, I mean, from basic and infantry training, you've been out there on the front. And was there anybody from your from boot camp that you ever crossed path with later on in active military life?
I never saw any of the guys in my basic. No, I saw one of them. I saw Rene Bravo years later at Fort Bragg. And then I saw another kid that I hadn't seen for years from my my officer candidate school class. I saw him at Fort Dix. So that was kind of weird. So it's like, it is a small army, because the great thing about being in the army is like saying you live in Chicago and people go, oh, do you know so-and-so?
Yeah.
You know, never mind that there's millions of, you know, the army is like, and they're like, oh, do you know so-and-so? No, no, I don't know so-and-so. Yeah,
that guy owes me $20.
They all do.
You watch a lot of movies, military movies, especially, you know, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the work that you do in helping people making military movies actually make it make sense in the way of doing military movies. But when you watch military films, is there a movie that sticks out with you as that's what life is like? Or, I mean, they all take artistic license, but is there anyone that you feel like that's how it is?
I don't know that's how, I mean, I think there's pieces of that's how it is in a number of them. I think in An Officer and a Gentleman, I mean, there's a version of the drill sergeant that is, or the drill instructor that is Lou Diamond Phillips. I mean, he does a terrific portrayal with, you know, the variations it's a movie. Gunny Hartman, Lee Ermey, is brilliant because he actually did it. He actually was a Marine drill sergeant, and he is playing the most over the top version of himself, and has said in interviews that, yeah, that wouldn't have happened. You know, that kind of like relentless, you know, dunning of the recruit. But a lot of it is exactly what happened. I mean, a lot of it, like, you know, if you've been through it, you kind of like, you know, twinge. I can remember, you know, the first week of basic training, and they tell you, you know, we're going to get up in the morning, and you're not up in the morning fast enough. And they literally took the bunk and flipped it over with me inside it, like just flipped it over, and I'm on my face, and there's a bed and a mattress and a bed frame on top of me. So yeah, things like that. Absolutely. I would recommend going through the basic training experience for any American, if for no other reason than for 14 weeks or however long it is now, no one cares what you think. You know, we grow up in a very privileged democratic society and everybody has an opinion. Dunning-Kruger is in full effect and everybody thinks that they have an opinion. Therefore, it's equal to, you know, the same as an actual entomologist, you know, but and it's just great because no one cares. Like, literally no one cares. Just shut up, do your job, do what you're told, and, you know, contribute to the common good. Later in the force, that will change. Then they do want your opinion. Then you're taught to understand the bigger picture and why, if you think, you know, I've issued orders to my soldiers, and you got everybody gathered together, and we walk everybody through the plan, and you go, does anybody see a problem? And you'll get some 19-year-old kid who's just out of basic training go, I don't understand why we're doing that. And you go, well, now that you mention it, I don't understand why we're doing that either, son. So let's go back and look at it. So everybody gets a vote. You train the guys to understand that, yeah, you're, if this goes badly, you're going to get killed. So if something looks stupid, speak up. but that comes later. In basic training, no one cares.
Yeah, just get up in the morning, do what they're telling you, and then go back to bed. And thank God you've got a cot to sleep on.
And there's nothing wakes you up more than having like a 55-gallon galvanized steel garbage can come flying down the squad bay at 3:45 a.m. and go bouncing, caroming off the linoleum. Good morning.
Oh boy! Wow. I do want to talk a little bit more about the work that you do with your veterans organization that teaches military protocols. How did you get? Where did you first come up in that group? How did that evolve?
So my very first time military advising was on an episode of a show called Amen, when the episode was about the lead character in a fit of pique joins the army and, absurd sitcom level basic training scenes with Richard Roundtree. But then she ends up in the airborne. And again, like 10 minutes after she joins, she's in the airborne, she's jumping out of a plane. The prop master, they had a military advisor and they brought over like they had rented parachutes, 10 parachutes, and they arrived on set not put together. And they went to the military advisor and goes, "Do you know how to put this together?" And he said, "I have no idea. I've jumped, but like they just put it on you." And try, yeah. And I had been skydiving for some years by then. And I said, "Hey, I could put that together for you." And I remember the assistant prop master looked at me and said, "Wait right there." And he walked over to the stage manager and said, "I'm stealing one of your background actors." Next thing I know, I'm in the crew. And I became like the lead actress's dresser, like, here, put the stuff on her and everything. It's just like, it was a whole different experience. And I thought, I'd much rather do that.
Yeah. But instead of milling about in the back.
Yeah, you know. But I would be on a show like China Beach, you know, Vietnam War show. And they'd say, you know, when this guy comes by, salute him. Okay. And then they'd say to some surfer guy from L.A., they'd say, "Hey, this guy comes by, salute him." And he's like, "How do you do that?" Mm-hmm. And then you're trying like, So I thought, you know, I bet if I showed up with a group of guys that knew how to do all of that, that life would be better and I would become more popular. not like high school. So I put this group together and started going from show to show. And that's what got me on people's radar. And when the movie Courage Under Fire, I knew the Army's military advisor, and at the time the Army was going to do the picture, but the show had hired a military advisor and then fired him. And he recommended me based on, you know, this work that I'd done bringing like 30 extras. And he told me one day we were working on a show and he said, "Your guys look better than the actors. Like, your guys actually look, you know, the actors are kind of flailing around, they're overweight and out of wear the uniform." You know, so it was like, oh, okay. So that was kind of how I got into doing that.
So I imagine show business is small enough industry that once word gets out that work comes to you.
Yes and no. I mean, I think it is an extremely competitive business, and I think it certainly helps. The more people you work with, the more people there are to say, "Oh yeah, I worked with him. He's good." Yeah. Or, you know, so I worked for Ed Zwick on a movie called Courage Under Fire. And I remember he wrote me a recommendation letter. And he the nicest thing I think anybody ever said about me professionally was whenever I needed him, he was always standing right behind me. He said, but otherwise he knew to shut the hell up. I mean, everybody's got an opinion, and when they need your opinion, that's great. But otherwise, just, you know, sit there and look pretty.
Hey, Rory, when you watch, you know, films that you didn't work on and have not benefited from your vast expertise, is there do you have a particular pet peeve that's like, oh, they always get this wrong, or I hate it when they get that wrong? For me, for example, like military haircuts drive me crazy and bad salutes drive me crazy. Do you have something similar?
Bad haircuts, bad salutes. Most of the actors are usually too old for the roles they play. Like in Saving Private Ryan, Ted Danson is playing a captain. He's like 50.
Right. Like,
no.
And oh, he's just really actor. Bad at it.
I was wondering if there's a trick to keep the actors from squinting when they're firing Tommy guns. I remember when you're on The Rocketeer and watching Paul Sorvino, and he's got his eyes just nailed shut as he's blasting away at Griffith Observatory.
So the problem is that you see in a movie like Private Ryan, where they had the budget and the time and the willingness to put the actors through basic training, you know, that also meant they spent a lot of money on blanks to give the actors the experience of actually doing that. On a movie like The Rocketeer, they probably handed Paul the gun like 5 minutes before he had to use it. Yeah. That probably, and the Tommy gun being a particular kind of weapon is not that common. Like a lot of people have fired an M16 on set, you know, a blank with blanks. But Tommy gun, pretty rare. I hadn't fired a Tommy gun on set that day, but you know, I chatted with the armorer, talked about how to, you know, because I had a jam, because all these weapons were very old. I had a jam on the set, and I like took cover and changed, pulled the magazine out, and cleared the jam, and got back up and started shooting. I don't think it made it into the scene, but it was. I had the familiarity, and I think Paul, they just go, okay, here, keep that part away from everybody, and just, you know, off you go. So, you know.
Yeah, no, and especially, you know, it's something on the Rocketeer, even a prop gun that's functional, or you know, it's functional in the sense that it will fire rounds, blank rounds. You don't get that opportunity that often to handle an automatic like that.
No, you don't.
But I imagine having people like you who have been around automatic weapons a lot, it's like you become a valuable property to people like the armorers.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, that's back when I was doing background work, and you didn't want to go, pick me, but you would let them know. It's like, oh, by the way, I'm in the army, I'm an armor officer, and be like, oh, okay, so I can turn my back on you, as opposed to some of the other guys who were in Paul Sorvino's situation of like, wait, what is this? So, again, these weapons are old, and it's not just that the gun itself is old. It's that the magazines, you know, those drum Tommy gun magazines, they're old as well, you know, and they wear out and they're more likely to have jams and things. So it's definitely becomes a huge challenge for the armorers, for the production, for everybody involved.
The way that things are going now with streaming and, you know, big cinematic movies are, well, they're either $300 million movies like the one that we're talking about here, or they're on, you know, they're on TV. There's no intimate movies as far as I've, there are very few intimate movies. Let me put it that way. So I was just wondering if from, in terms of your work, other than, you know, gigantic blockbusters, is work still coming your way that often, or how does that, How is the current market changing like that?
Well, production is way down in general. There are not a huge number of war films being made, and if they are, they're probably being shot overseas, and they hire a guy that over there because it saves money. I worked in May on the Steven Spielberg movie, and it was because I had worked with the same assistant directing team on the Marty Supreme movie. So they said, hey, we got a thing. And Marty Supreme was like one scene, you know, I came out, I did some prep, and we did the scene, and that was it. It's just one scene in the movie, but they wanted to get it as right as they could. Same thing with the Spielberg movie, the Disclosure Day. They had some flashback scenes with the military. And I was brought in to do all the things that I do, but just for 3 days. You know, it wasn't like I was there for the whole time. I did 2 weeks of prep, and then we shot the scenes, and that was it. You know, so they had been shooting for like 4 months. I just came in at the tail end of it. And I think a lot of the work I get is like that, or it's television. Law and Order wants to shoot an episode about a court-martial, and you come in for the week or the week before the shoot, and then you come for the shoot and you help with, you know, costumes, props, actors, directors, you know, whoever has questions about the military experience, you're there to kind of lend your thoughts. So,
yeah, and just making sure their cover's on right and their, you know, the epaulets are in the right spots. Like Hal was saying, I would imagine any veteran watching things you get a little twitchy. It's like, no, that's not how it goes.
It's funny because you can put yourself in the shoes of whoever, either A, there was no military advisor, and that's usually pretty evident, but even when they have one, they can only do what they're allowed to do. And then there's some problems you're never going to solve. Like if you're doing a movie and it's set in the Army when people are wearing berets, that dog won't hunt, because in real life, like, you have your beret and you take that thing and you shave the fuzz off it and you soak it in boiling water, and then you take it when it's like wet and you put it on your head and you start shaping it to within an inch of your life so that you look like, you know, Joe Johnny Commando, and it's a thing of beauty. When you show up in a movie set and there's supposed to be 50 people wearing those, nobody's hat's going to look good. You know, somebody, it looks like a black felt Brady boat, and you're running around trying to get everybody sorted out, but really you've got to focus on the actors, the lead actors. I did an episode of a show, and Lou Diamond Phillips, who I'd worked with before, Lou is there and he's got the beret on, and like between takes, I'm trying to like smooth the beret down so it stops like riding up on his head. Because it, you know, I don't want Lou to look dumb. I mean, no one will really notice the background actors, but if Lou is like, you know, having a close up and his hat's kind of like tilting back up and he looks like, you know, puffin' fresh, you know, then no, this is not good. So I'll never work in this town again.
I have to say that Black Felt Gravy Boat is my new favorite band name. So I'm making a note of that. You never know.
Look for their debut album next week. Yeah.
My friend mentioned, he was talking about, they were talking about chutney, and he mentioned that ketchup was chutney adjacent, and that is not my new Premier League team.
Yeah. I'm writing that one down. That's a good one.
That's perfect.
Wow. I keep thinking that Tommy Lee Jones in this, Tommy Lee Jones always plays Tommy Lee Jones in every movie that he's in. But I think in terms of pulling him out for military stuff, he seems to always be the ideal. Like, if you can't get Ed Harris, or you can't, you have to get Tommy Lee Jones, because he's going to be the military guy that you want on screen. But like you said, Rory, they're all aging out. And I don't know. I keep trying to think of younger actors who fit in the military mold for, you know, how we're familiar with movie military guys. Can you think of any current generation people that look the part?
You know, off the top of my head, no. But I mean, it's that they're there.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the idea that they're always casting people who are too old.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, I mean, how old is Tommy Lee Jones in that scene? And he's terrific, you know, he's got more gravitas than, like, you know, the entire, you know, Westlake High School class of 1987. But I mean, it's just, he's too old. And he's also, they have him as a colonel, you know. Yeah. It's like, so if you're older, you'd be a general. And I mean, to me, looking at Captain America, to me, the project would be evocative of the Manhattan Project. Like, this is a war winner who's our best guy.
Right.
And, you know, in Manhattan Project, it was Leslie Groves. And Leslie Groves, at the time he's assigned, is like 45, 46 years old. And he's, you know, he's a general officer. You look at Paul Tibbetts, who is put in charge of the 509 Composite Group, the Enola Gay's pilot. And he's like 29. You know, I mean, he's a young guy, amazing combat record, but a young guy, you know. And so when I look at Captain America, I think, yeah, they should have cast somebody with like 40. And, you know, he's a colonel, or he's a brigadier general, but he's like the smart guy you put in charge of, how are we going to solve this problem? You know, who's our best young thinker who's going to, we can put in charge of this and know exactly what we're going to need over and above, oh, he's a good soldier, you know, so.
Yeah, no, the counter that I always think of when you're, you know, when you're little, everybody slightly older than you, you know, they could be in their 20s, they look like they're, you know, old man of the mountain. And I keep thinking, like, you know, Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, he was 37, 38 years old. And it's, I always thought, yeah, oh, he's got to be in his 50s or something. And, you know, Buzz Aldrin, same age, 37. And Gus Grissom in Liberty Bell 7 was, he was like 33. But they all, you know, you look at them and they all look like they're just ready for retirement.
Yeah.
So it's just, I mean, I guess we've been programmed by how, I mean, of course, you know, a pack of camels a day doesn't help your visage, you know.
Well, in World War II, you also have to factor in that all these guys went through the Depression when they were young.
Yeah.
And it aged a lot of them, you know, it aged them, you know, like you lost years off your life from malnutrition. So, yeah. I mean, I get that. And certainly, you know, Hollywood's never going to cast an 18-year-old kid, you know, unless it's Timothy Chalamet to play something. But, you know, you wish they would go, okay, let's at least bring it down a little bit, you know, because, yeah, I mean, it's just, you're looking, like, at the moment Tommy Lee Jones walks on screen, and I've enjoyed him in so many movies, but he walks on the screen in this, and, like, you're too old. You're the wrong guy.
You know, you mentioned World War II. It reminds me of my grandfather enlisted in World War II, and he was a corporal, but he was like 32 years old, and he was the old man. He was like,
yes,
he was ancient, especially as a corporal, and he served admirably and well, and did his job. But the rest of his life, he always talked about how he felt like, you know, the old man on the mountain, being 32 years old with a bunch of 20-year-olds.
There's do they call them pops?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a guy in my basic training class in 87, and he's like 34 years old. I felt old at 25. He's 34. And I think we were cleaning the latrine with toothbrushes or some other worthwhile endeavor. And I said to him, I got to ask your brother, I said, what are you doing here? He said, I worked at the mill. I said, I got a wife and four kids, and they closed the mill. He said, you know what? The kids aren't interested in your excuses. Like, you got to feed, you got to take care of your family. Army had a job immediately. He said, so I took it. I was like, well, good on you. I respect the hell out of you, man. You didn't make excuses. You're just like, all right, not the life I thought I was going to have.
Yeah.
And the drill sergeants got it. I mean, like, they weren't easy on him, but they kind of put him in charge of things. And you could tell that as soon as he graduated basic training, like, somebody was going to go, let's promote this guy. He's obviously ready for sergeant now. So, yeah, good dude. Really good dude.
I was thinking of a movie that lampshaded this was Apocalypse Now, when Martin Sheen is going through Colonel Kurtz's dossier, and he talks about him joining Airborne at 38. 38 jumping out of a plane? I don't think so. But you know, that it explains why you had old fat Marlon Brando up in the, you know, up the river, and he's still somehow commanding troops in the field. And he was only a colonel at the time, you know, so it's like, okay, that part made sense.
You think of all the things that they had to change because Marlon Brando showed up fat, out of shape, hadn't read the script, and hadn't read Heart of Darkness. he's like the null set.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if you've seen Hearts of Darkness, the documentary about making.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
brilliant. You're like, oh my god. So
no, it's just amazing. It's amazing that any of the people involved in that thing survived doing. I mean, you know, between the Philippine rebels and things.
The typhoon.
And Martin Sheen's heart attack and bleeding on the don't cut, keep rolling, and just all that kind. Well, we're never going to do the Apocalypse Now minute. Somebody else has done it, you know, God bless them, but
don't look at the camera, pretend you're fighting.
Yeah. It's for television. But yeah, somewhere somebody's doing it. Rory, if they need a guest, I will get you. I'll get you on there in a minute. But
So a brief outtake for Apocalypse Now. I was working on a movie in Thailand, and my friend said, "Hey, come on, I want you to meet Frenchie." And this is 1997. And so we go and we have dinner. Frenchie owns a French restaurant in Bangkok. This is really fun. And Pat tells me, he's like, "Oh, Frenchie was a military advisor on Apocalypse Now." I said, "For what?" He said, "For the Foreign Legion scene." I said, "What Foreign Legion scene?"
Wow.
Because I had never seen, like, it hadn't been released.
Yeah, the extended one, yeah.
Yeah, he told me this whole story. I was like, "That's brilliant." So anyway, sorry.
Wow. That's it. Okay, yeah, that's one of those Mad Lib things. Like, there you were in Bangkok, and seeing a military advisor. Yeah. Wow. Well, Rory, this has been great having you on this show. I like it when you can set us straight on how things are going. I mean, I know, you know, maybe things are different when you've got super soldier serum on the line here, and they have to do the training a little bit different. But apart from that, you know, painting rocks and putting dirt in somebody's hole and putting the hole back in somebody's dirt, you know, I realize that's a little bit more of the common ones. But who knows? Maybe, you know, Camp Lehigh runs a little different.
Camp Lehigh was always different.
Yes. Wow. Well, again, thanks for being a part of the show. I'd also like to thank our audience for sticking with us. If you are interested in continuing the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, If you'd like to continue our conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.